I want to thank the elders first for allowing me to sit in the pew for a couple of weeks with the events of the last couple of weeks. Appreciate that. Appreciate those men that filled in for me. We got so many capable men here that it's not a difficult. Of course, Bill says they line up to when I'm going to be gone. So I got to be careful, but I do appreciate it. I concur with what my niece wrote, certainly on that card. You are great people, and I'm still struggling, and you're still encouraging me, and I need you to do that. I feel like some days half of me is gone. And it is. That's what the Bible says when you get married. Two become one. So you're no longer two but one. So that means a half is gone. So I continue to need your prayers and your other areas of show of concern. But we have to get back to the business at hand. Urgency of winning souls. In this chapter, John, first chapter, one of the most amazing things is set forth there, but it's often overlooked. Brethren rightfully are concerned about different means and methods of trying to reach the lost. And sometimes overlooked in all of the various programs and things out there that brethren have tried, and many of them are effective to the extent that they can be. What is often overlooked is the very simple plan in verse 40 and 41. One of the two who heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He found first his own brother Simon and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which translated means Christ. He found his own brother. What a plan that is. Just concentrate on one person. We develop programs to try to sometimes reach the mass of people, but don't forget just the importance of finding one person and trying to spread the gospel that way, trying to give them the opportunity to be saved. Indifference hinders us, not a deliberate indifference, not I'm going to turn my back on the lost deliberately, but other things become more important. Let's face it, we get caught up in the business of life. And sometimes things that are really more important don't seem to take front and center position. But winning souls is not optional. It is our task to take the gospel into the world and try to reach the lost with it. Give them at least the opportunity to hear it. We take a lost world for granted. How many of you live near a railroad track? I don't live right close to one, but there's one not too far away. I never hear those trains. I did when we first moved in. I'm used to them now. I have to consciously think about it in order to hear a train rumbling through that area. We get used to it like that. And we get used to a lost world in the same way. Or we may have decided, you know, it's a hopeless task. There are so few of us and there are so many that are lost. How could we possibly make a dent in it? Make any kind of impression at all? Well, let's talk about it. Think about the vastness of the task. I looked this up to get the latest statistics for this year. Supposedly, it's not over yet, but that's the year they're giving them for. There are more than 7 billion people in the world. 7 billion. That puts our, 300 million in perspective. Every minute, according to what they claim, there are 105 people dying. So there have been several deaths in the world since I started talking. 105 people. Interestingly enough, statistics several years ago was 107 per minute. So really not sure what's causing that slight difference. So that's a lot of people. Most of whom are leaving the world unprepared. They're not ready to meet God in judgment. But they've gone on to that appointment anyway. The most effective method is what we talked about over there in John 1, 41, 42. One-on-one. He found his own brother first, and he taught him. He said, you got to come and listen to what I did. Matter of fact, all he did was invite him to come. You need to hear what I've heard. And sometimes maybe that's what we're capable of doing, inviting someone to come. Maybe we don't feel like we're capable of actually doing the teaching, but there are those that are. And so just do that. That's the method used by Philip. That was a one-on-one situation. The eunuch is traveling along. He's reading from Isaiah chapter 53, but as this thing unfolds, obviously, he does not understand about whom the prophet was speaking. And so Philip said, do you understand what you're reading? No, I don't. Who is this talking about? Philip, on a one-on-one situation, then, of course, began to talk to him about Jesus Christ and show him that that's who this is about. Isaiah was talking about Jesus Christ and taught him all that was necessary, that was involved, and notice involved in talking about Jesus to him. Somewhere in talking about Jesus, baptism came up. There are so many people in the religious world who want to discount the value of baptism. Well, we'll take care of that eventually. In fact, we save up for 2 or 3 months for that. They didn't do that. They're riding along in a chariot. He's been taught about Jesus, which includes also the kingdom and baptism, apparently, because it was not Philip that first suggested baptism. It was the eunuch. See, here is water. What doth hinder me from being baptized? And as Duane brought out in class, they both went down into the water and came up out of the water. It would hardly be necessary if baptism be accomplished in some way other than immersion. One-on-one. Good method. Still works every time it's tried. We have the water to put out the fire. The water is the gospel. The fire is that people are being lost all around us. We've got what it takes to give them an opportunity to have eternal life. Task is great. The nature of the soul. It really boggles my mind that a lot of people cannot see that there is a difference between human and animals. Of course, they've been taught that there is no difference, that we are a sophisticated animal, but we're not. We're made in God's image. That is not said of any other living being. Regardless of how intelligent they think these beings are, they're not made in God's image. We are. We are immortal. Our soul, our spirit will live on after this life is over. That's not true of the animal world. When that animal comes to the end of his days, that is it. As that long time ago when I was a kid, preachers used to say this. They're like little dog Rover. They're dead all over. And that's exactly the way it is, but not with us. There is a part of us that will live on. Paul tried to get that point across to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17. They were religious people. They worshiped the multiplicity of gods. They had all kinds of gods. They had one over here to the unknown God. Paul says, that's the one you need to know about, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about, that unknown God. And so he proceeded to do that. He said, while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. What therefore you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he's Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. He's not served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life and breath and all things. God's not dependent on us. We are dependent upon him. Verse 29 says, we then are the offspring of God. Therefore, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or art, an image formed by the art and thought of man. We're in God's image. There is a part of us that is immortal. We will exist forever somewhere. That's our soul. That's our spirit. Yes, we share life with the animal world. They have life, they breathe, we breathe, but we're not like them. Despite the fact that some people act like it. In fact, they act worse than animals. We have a conscious existence forever. Abraham Lincoln said man was made for eternity. He must have been somewhat of a religious man. There are, of course, groups like the Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Mormons, and others who deny this truth. They say that only those selected people, only the faithful live forever. All those who the Bible teaches are destined to torment, they just cease to exist. That's their punishment. That's hell for them. They just don't get to enjoy heaven. That's not what the Bible teaches, but that's what they teach. So we're talking about that part of man which lives on forever. Jesus said in Matthew 10:28, "Fear not him that can destroy the body, but cannot destroy the soul, but fear him that can destroy both body and soul in hell." And hell is not just a moment's passing. It's eternal. Paul talked about this immortal part of us in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. He said in verse 16, "Do not lose heart. Though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day." Our spirit is a part of us. This, what you see, is going to someday crumble away. And so he goes on to say that momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. "While we look not at things which are seen, but things that are not seen. Things which are seen are temporal." That's this body, this temporary home of the soul. "But the things which are not seen are eternal." That's the immortal part of us, what we call our soul, our spirit. There's some variations in the use of that word in the Bible, but a lot of times it's interchangeable. And then in chapter 5, it's a shame there's a chapter division there, because he's still talking about the same thing. That when this earthly tabernacle is torn down, when it crumbles around us, we still have that building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. So you and I have an immortal spirit. When this life is over for us, that's not the end of us. That's why we have the hope of heaven. That's for our home of our spirit, not this mortal body. And as he said in verse 4, "Indeed, while we are in this tent, we groan, being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, in order that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life." Several times in the last few months, Jane said, "I want to go home." I knew what she meant. She wasn't talking about her house either. She was already there. She was in the house. But she wanted to go home. That's what Paul's talking about right here. That existence. When we get past this life. We need to talk about the presence of Satan when we talk about the urgency of winning souls. What does it mean to have an enemy? What is an enemy? Well, out there in the animal kingdom, all animals have a natural enemy. They have another animal that just can't wait to have them for lunch or supper. Or dinner and supper, as I like to say. But I accommodate those that aren't from the South, say lunch. And they all have one. And that's just a part of the cycle that God put in place, and it preserves the balance of nature. Men try to interfere with that sometime. "Oh, the poor Bambi there. Let's not allow people to kill Bambi. Then we get overrun by deer. We have more accidents on the highway because somebody somewhere in their intelligence thinks that we should preserve one animal or another. No, you're going to upset the balance of what God has put in place. It's natural for those animals to have a predator that is seeking to eat them. That's their enemy. Well, we have an enemy. That's Satan. And he's always busy. In Job, it says that Satan presented himself before God, and he was asked, "Where have you been?" Well, yeah, his answer is something that we already know. Well, he said, "I've been walking to and fro upon the earth. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" He said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." That's kind of what Peter was talking about, wasn't it? Our adversary, the devil, walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He's out to harm us. He does not have our best interest at heart. Now, he lies about that. Through various means, through people sometimes, the advertising world is great about lying and covering up what Satan's true desire is. Everything is portrayed that is sin. Many things that are sinful and wrong are portrayed as being good for man. They're not good for us. They're harmful, both physically sometimes and spiritually, but especially spiritually. And yet, that's how it's presented. He's the great deceiver. Satan knows that sin is deadly. Ezekiel 18:4, "The soul that sins shall die." In that chapter, of course, he's trying to get them to realize the individual responsibility for sin. You can't blame somebody else for your sin. Somebody else will not be accountable for your sin. Sin is put to the account of the one who commits it, and no one else. Romans 6:23, "The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life." Satan knows all of this. He's very much aware of all this. We sometimes may forget it, but he doesn't. And God has given us this marvelous opportunity to make a choice. And it's described in the 6th chapter of Romans as either being a slave of sin, which results in death, in verse 16, or of obedience resulting in righteousness. God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, you became obedient from the heart to that form of teaching to which you committed, and having been freed from sin, became slaves of righteousness. That's the process. You read about it earlier in chapter 6. You follow the plan. You're buried in water for remission of sins. Put to death the old man of sin. You make that conscious choice. Satan is going to do everything he can to keep you from doing that. He's going to urge you to just do anything but that. So we talk about the urgency of soul winning. We have to talk about the presence of Satan. He's out there trying to thwart every effort we're making, trying to get us to stop the effort that we're making, trying to get the person we're trying to teach to no longer pay attention to what God's Word says. Anything and everything that he can do, he will do. You can just count on it. I think I've mentioned before, when I was over here at Connersville, one of the elders and I were having a Bible study with this woman. I think she had made contact through the radio program, if I remember that part right. A friend of hers came by one day. She related this to us later and asked her what she'd been doing lately. She's an elderly woman. She said, "Well, I've been having a Bible study." "Oh, we've been studying with?" "Well, I've been studying with a couple men from the Church of Christ out there on Waterloo Road." It's got a different address now, but... "Oh, Leela. Oh, Leela, don't study with them. Study with anybody. Don't study with those people." Now, who do you think was behind that? He may have been a well-meaning man. I don't know what his experience had been as far as contact with members of the church. But the fellow behind that, the person behind that really was Satan. That was Satan using him to thwart our effort to teach that woman. Now, she didn't pay attention to his advice, but Satan was doing everything he could to misrepresent us. We'll talk about a bit more about some of that in the next lesson. That's what he does. That's his job, and he does it very well. We need to talk about the brevity of life when we talk about the urgency of winning souls. Truth of the matter is, we begin to die when we're born. We start clicking off the days until the day of our death. Our life, James says, he said, what is your life? He said, it's but a vapor that appears for a little while and then it vanishes away. How true that is. Somehow or other, I hit 70 years old a couple weeks ago. I don't know how that happened. I know that my dad was 70 at one time, and my mom, and I don't know how I got there. I don't know how I got there so quickly. But I'm there. And some of you have a few years on me. Where'd they all go? It seemed like it was yesterday. had to get a copy of my marriage license to file for Social Security. I was just looking at it. It came in the mail yesterday. There's my dad. He did the ceremony. He filled out his part. He signed it. I thought to myself, wow, it just seems like yesterday we signed that thing. And yet 46 years plus has gone by. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. That's what happened. That's what James is talking about. It's like a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. It's gone. Benjamin Franklin said, time is what life is made of. And that time goes by very quickly. And the sobering reality is, when this life is over, death and judgment await us. It's an appointment we're all going to keep. Hebrews 9:27. It's appointed unto man once to die, and after this, the judgment. There's nobody going to escape that judgment. They may escape death by the Lord's return. There will be some living when he returns. But judgment, they will not escape. That is an appointment that everyone is going to keep. And we're all on that occasion going to be held accountable for what we did in this life. I will not be accountable for anyone else. No one will be accountable for me or for you, but it's an individual thing. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body, according to what he has done, whether good or bad. When you're in school, sometimes the teacher will just use a strict application of percentages to determine the grade on a test or something like that. But once in a while, particularly if almost all of the students did really horrible on a particular test, or at least I did this, then I might grade that one on a curve, which really means I'm lowering the standards that normally I would apply in judging that test. Sometimes I think people think the Lord's going to do that. He's going to grade on a curve. He's just going to somehow take his standard down. So, you know, that an A normally might be 92% or 94%. Well, let's just make an A 90%. We're going to grade that on the curve. And they think maybe God's going to do that. Maybe God will overlook some of the things they did that was wrong, because they offset a lot of those evil things with some good things. And that somehow God's going to balance all that out, but end up compromising his standard. There is no indication he's going to do that. We're going to give account of the deeds that have been done in the body, whether good or bad. Nothing's going to be forgotten. There'll be no grading on the curve, but it will be judged according to what the book says. And that's an urgent thing that we need to understand. When we talk about the urgency of winning souls, that all these people out here, 105 every minute, are now awaiting judgment. And as I said, the vast majority of them, they're not prepared. They're not ready. The tragedy of it is that maybe some of them got the teaching they needed but didn't obey it, and time ran out for them. Urgency of winning souls. Heaven and hell. I think there's always a constant desire on most part of it, part of most of us, to know a little bit more about heaven, isn't there? I know that God has told us everything we need to know about it, but we certainly would not say that what we would like to know has all been revealed. But God doesn't work according to what we think anyway. And when you consider what has been revealed about heaven, it's hard to fathom anyway. Here's an infinite being, God, trying to describe something to finite being, man, that is just about beyond our comprehension. But it is a magnificent place. John, the Revelation writer, chapter 4, verses 1 to 4, said, "After these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven, and the first voice I heard, like the sound of a trumpet speaking with me, said, 'Come up here. I'll show you what must take place after these things.' Immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was standing in heaven, and one sitting on the throne. And he was sitting like a jasper stone, and a sardius in appearance, and there was a rainbow around the throne, like an emerald in appearance. And around the throne were 24 thrones, and upon the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white garments and golden crowns on their heads." And then he just proceeds on to talk about it some more. Can you fathom that, really? It's unbelievable. God did the very best he could with our limitation. God wasn't limited in trying to describe that. We're limited in trying to understand it when we read it. The song says, we read of a place called heaven, how beautiful heaven must be. Sweet home of the happy and free. Fair haven of rest for the weary. How beautiful heaven must be. What a place. What a place. A place where all of the harmful, hurtful, horrific things of this life will be over. Be bothered no more by them, because many of them pertain to this fleshly tabernacle, and it will be no more. And all then that happens while we're in the flesh, that's gone, that's over. None of those terrible things, they're gone. Just think of all of them, they're gone. They're not around anymore. And not only that, I firmly believe, based on David's statement in 2 Samuel 12 and other things, go back and look in the Old Testament at when the patriarchs died. In each case, it was said that they were gathered to their fathers. There'd be no point in that if there wasn't some kind of recognition of one another. Certainly we know, according to what Jesus said, there'll be no marriage. Someone, and I don't remember who it was now, said, well, just think, you can be reunited someday with Jane. I thought about it for a second, and I said, yeah. And the good news for her is she won't have to be married to me. That's true. It's true. David has just experienced the loss of the baby born of his illicit relationship with Bathsheba. And his behavior was very strange. Those around him couldn't quite understand what was going on. Verse 18, for example, they said, behold, while the child was still alive, we spoke to him and he did not listen to our voice. How then can we tell him that the child is dead, since he might do himself harm? They were really concerned about him. It was like he was in another world. And they were afraid to break through with the news that the child had died. We just put him over the edge. David saw them whispering and he said, is the child dead? They said, he's dead. But far from going out and killing himself, David arose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, changed his clothes, came into the house of the Lord and worshiped. Then he came to his own house, and when he requested, they brought food before him. The servants, they just had to ask about it and said, what is this thing you have done? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept. But when that child died, you arose and ate food. He said, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. That's right. For I said, who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me that the child may live. David was showing the piety that he was with the desire that if it be God's will, that child wouldn't die. But that's not what happened. And now he has died. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. I think there's some comfort in that. Those that we have loved, who put their faith and trust in the Lord, I firmly believe we'll see them someday. though the earthly relationship we had will be no more. But if you think about it, Peter prepares us for that concept when he talks about the proper treatment of wives by husbands. What is the husband supposed to remember? That she's an heir together of the grace of life, not simply his wife, which is an earthly relationship, but a fellow heir of the grace of God. So, and over on the other side, hell is a terrible place. Like heaven, it's eternal. The same word is used to describe both heaven and hell. Translators, for some reason, in some translations, make a distinction. One of them, time, they use the word everlasting, and the other one, they say eternal, but they mean the same thing, and it's the same word in the Greek. There really isn't any reason for them to change the word they're going to translate that with. Why they did that, I don't know. Talked about that in class this morning. They do some strange things. Hell, on the other hand, is also described in graphic terms. In the 9th chapter of Mark, Jesus is rebuking people for not properly believing in him. He's performed miracles in front of them. But he said, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe to stumble, it'd be better for him if a heavy millstone around his neck had been cast in the sea. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. Better for you to enter into life crippled than having two hands to go into hell, into the unquenchable fire, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. The word for hell there is Gehenna. It was used literally in Jesus' day to describe the dump outside the city of Jerusalem. If any of you, and maybe you haven't, but I remember as a boy, we could take things to the city dump, pay a nominal fee, and drive back there and dump it. But what you notice when you go in there, is, besides the odor, is there are little bitty things burning here and burning there. Well, that's what that was. That burned continually outside the city there. And so Jesus was using a word would bring to their mind something that is not quenched, and that's the fires of hell. Something to think about when we're talking about urgency of winning souls, because we're all going to be going to one place or the other. The job is to prevent some from going to hell. Greatest thing we can do for other people is teach them. There's a lot of things we can do for them, and nothing wrong with doing that, but the greatest thing is to teach them the gospel and to make it a priority. Maybe you're here this morning and you given thought to things we've talked about, but you just haven't surrendered yet. You're still trying to figure out some way you can go through this life and please God without becoming a Christian. You can't do it. And you need his help to get through life, I'll tell you that. But if you're here this morning and you're in that condition, we urge you to take the opportunity you have now. Come down the aisle and give God your heart. And let us assist you in obeying the gospel. But maybe you've done that and you got some sin in your life that needs to be corrected. Do that today too. You let us know as we stand and sing together.